Today we're happy to welcome our speaker, Catherine Claren Bach. Bach, who currently serves the First Unitarian Church of Portland as a intern minister. She loves learning the myths, stories, and beliefs of other cultures, especially those about the creation of earth, life, and human beings. She and her wife, Julie, live with two enormous dogs and two mischievous cats. Welcome, Catherine.
Before I begin, I just want to thank all of you for your welcome. The feeling in this room is wonderful. And the busyness and work to create this community space on a Sunday was like an organized beehive. It was wonderful. So I'm very, very happy to be here. And today I'm going to talk about ancestors and the honor and ambivalence that we may have about our ancestors. But I do speak to honor those who have died in this church community over the past year. I speak to honor Dr. Maya Angelou, who passed just a couple weeks ago. And as many traditions teach, I cannot speak without honoring my own ancestors of blood and bone and love and spirit. And as it's Father's Day, I thought I would name my father, John Dawson Carl Buck, who changed the lives of hundreds of undergraduates, and his father, Earl Buck, who was shot during World War II, of Earl's father, Carl, orphaned young and made a ward of the state, of my grandmother's father, John Dawson, of my mother's father, Leo Van Birmingham, a father of 12, eighth grade teacher and dairy farmer. In honor of all the fathers, mothers, aunts, uncles, and cousins I claim as my ancestors. And in honor of our Unitarian Universalist ancestors, in honor of those members of this community, and in honor of ancestors of color, especially those foremothers and forefathers who struggled to make a way in this faith tradition. In honor of all the ancestors, of all of you gathered here whom you know and whom you don't know, ancestors of the body, ancestors of families adopted and claimed, ancestors of aspiration, our heroes, our heroines from our background, as well as ancestors of the cautionary tale, those we see who were oppressive and from whom we want to turn away, ancestors of the spirit, whose lives call out to us across generations and whom we name and claim as our own. Who are your ancestors, named and unnamed? You may have known them in life, or you may not. They may have lived and died unknown to you in famine and plague, in war, in childbirth. Still, they are yours. Let us take just a moment in silence to call to mind those whose names we might know or those we might claim. And as we're moved, please say their names into the space of this assembly. Florence Antonia Fender.
Lawrence Walker de Chatelet.
Rolf Steven Gabrielson.
Orban Moffat.
Kristen Bennett Birmingham. Anna Lisa Clarenbach. By naming our ancestors, we call them to mind and in some way make them present here with us. We have the chance to thank them for the gifts they've given and remember that we live and move and create in a world they have lived in and moved in and created in. Indeed, gratitude for ancestors is central to many traditions around the world. Every inhabited part of the world I can think of has some way of honoring the dead. In fact, I would not be surprised if ancestor veneration were as old as human consciousness. We lose people we love. We long for them to speak to us, to return somehow, in some form, to this world in which we live. We call to them in the darkness of our hearts' nights, and we bury them even now, sometimes, with beloved objects, coffins like miniature versions of ancient Egyptian royal tombs or Gaelic barrows. We offer them our joys, our sorrows, little stones and flowers by their graves. And in some traditions, we pray every day for them or to them, every month for 11 months after they have died. We scatter the ashes of their bodies to be carried by air, land, or water, or to fertilize roses. I think, though, that there is something more than the pains of loss or grief in the foundation of ancestor veneration. Honoring our dead reminds us that we are all human. And honoring those who've gone before us, who are behind us, those on whose shoulders we most certainly stand, recognizes that we are fundamentally connected to the present, past, and future. Coming to know our ancestors helps us see ourselves in the mirrors of their lives, and we see our place in the web more clearly. It is not only, certainly not only, nearest biological family that connects us. Because many of us are adopted. Many of us claim spiritual ancestors or intellectual, inspiring ancestors, philosophical ancestors, people who have made us who we are. Certainly, it is our DNA going back 70,000 years that connects the human web over time. It is our shared humanness that connects us across difference, holding us in one being, all birthed out of Africa, all related to every other life form on this earth. Just think about that. We are brothers and sisters, siblings of every single thing that lives on this earth. And indeed, connection and ancestry go all the way past stardust explosions at the beginning of things. But it is our human ancestry that concerns us now and that shows us the impact of history, reminds us of our strengths and our failings, and calls us to do better than we might otherwise do. Honoring our dead reminds us that we share responsibility for the earth and for the great cloud of our descendants. We will leave gifts of pain and joy to those who come after us. We will. We cannot help it. But we can work hard to choose what we leave. Ancestry is a history of gifts, mistakes and beauty, glory and oppression. For example, Dr. Maya Angelou taught a generation of women, and especially Black women, how to live in the world affected but not broken by racism, classism, other prejudice, and violence. For example, Dr. Angelou reminded me when I met her in 1994 that we need poetry to live, to truly live, to truly be alive. We need, she said, to press it against our teeth. And she went like this. She said, press it up against your teeth. Chew it like meat. And it was in that glorious voice of hers. And so I offer one of her gifts, a small excerpt from her iconic poem, Still I Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, she said. I rise, she said to us. I rise. Dr. Maya Angelou is my ancestor, and she is the ancestor of everyone who sits here today. In her insistence on the right to be proud, she is our ancestor. In her reminder of the gifts of our forebears, she is our ancestor. What does that mean? As we hear, as we touch and sit and stand beside one another, we affect one another. We are affected by one another. And Dr. Angelou is in the blood of this culture now. And there is no one here who has not taken in some piece of her being, even if it's just that poem I read. There is nothing we do, no thought we think, that has not been touched by another human being. Our thoughts and feelings express themselves in words and actions, however small. The collection of our full human experience is woven impossibly tightly with the experiences of others. And yet it is indeed woven so tightly that there really is no space between us. There is no individual without the all. And if there is no individual without the all, there is no future without the past. There is no way of living in the present without consequence. The interdependent web of existence our UU principles talk about. And it's much larger and more complex than I usually allow myself to think about. Many of us have heard of the butterfly effect. Butterfly flaps her wings in Peru and the weather in Montana changes. I believe in the butterfly effect, I do. But I know more than I believe that the weather in Montana and everywhere else is being affected by choices that human beings have made for hundreds of years. And that honestly had their seedbed in agricultural practices of millennia ago. accelerated climate change as it is occurring is the result of choices human beings have made and are still making. The future is shaped by the past. And it is a call for us to learn from the choices of our beloved dead, and yet, in honoring them, in loving them, still to make different choices from those they made. There is a convenient spiritual teaching in many traditions, however, that those now past are considered to have gotten smarter since they died. In fact, I spoke to a priest of the Ifa religion of the Yoruba people of Nigeria, and he said, "Honey, don't worry about your cranky grandmother. Don't worry about your abusive aunt. Really, they're okay now. And they're way, way smarter than they ever were before." And I took great comfort in that, even though that is not my religion, that not my path. I kind of like that idea. We need not be left only with the choices that they made. We can honor them and still choose differently. And so we spoke their names. We tell the stories we know and reach toward the stories we don't know. We recognize that what we do every day changes Earth and all she bears, all the people and all other beings, whether we like it or not. We recognize that much of what we have received from those who have preceded us into death, and that what they give us most of all is great responsibility. But we need not bear that responsibility alone. We can, as the Senegalese poet Birago Diop wrote, and the Washington, D.C. choir, Sweet Honey in the Rock, sings, we can listen to the wind, we can look into the fire, we can go to the edge of the sea and feel the fertile earth, because, as Diop says, the dead are never ever gone. The dead have a pact with the living. And we can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we carry each and every one of our ancestors with us. Their gifts are our gifts. Their lives go on in our lives. Their breath is now our breath. And their power to choose is our power now. Will you enter with me into a spirit of contemplation? Great ones who have gone before us, we address you now in our hearts, minds, and with our bodies. As your children, your children's children, your inheritors of so much, we call you the ones we know and the ones we do not know. May we go with knowledge both of gratitude and responsibility. You give us much of what we are, and for that we are grateful. And you give us much of what we must work to change, and with that we struggle. Help us today and every day to be wise children whose lives give honor to all that you were and all that you continue to be through us. In the name of all the gods and none, in the one name, which is love. Amen. I understand we have a conversation now. Is that right? Okay. I'm going to sit down here.
It is time for questions and comments. Loving words.
Yeah.
How did you come to create this sermon?
Oh, what a great question. It's a topic about which I'm, or in which I'm very interested. Because of my interest in world religions, I'm very interested in ancestor veneration. And because I am lucky to know and have evidence, physical evidence, of the lives of many of my ancestors. I have a tintype picture of my great-grandmother, age 6, with her grandmother in their Stuart tartans, and my great-great-great-grandmother looks very stern in the picture. Yes?
I don't really have a question, but so much as I have heard that children who know their family story do better in life. They do better in school and, you know, just become, just are more grounded in their world. And growing up, I have a very rich history from the Bethany area with my family there. I grew up knowing that story very well. Lived my first 5 years on their homestead. And that story just really spoke to me, and knowing that when my parents got divorced, I think that is really what saved me, is knowing that story and knowing that I will be okay. You know, there's been worse before me, and and I still find such comfort going back to that farmhouse and seeing it there, and it's just, but some people aren't so drawn to their past or their family story. So what do you think, maybe some people just seem, like for me it was just part of my, I just can't, everything I, you know, did, I saved things, I had this sense of I have to save this for when I'm old, and some people don't have that so much, so, you know.
Well, one thing I will say is that I know that family stories, can you hear me in the very back? Okay. I know that family stories help kids who move around a lot. Because moving around a lot affects memory and can affect your sense of where, what happened when I was 8. Well, I was living in Virginia Beach, and so that means that this was happening. It's easier for kids who have hear family stories over and over, but not everybody has a lot of family stories, and we need to help create the idea of forebears and exemplars who can be important for our kids. Yes?
I've experienced the kind of satisfaction I think that we're sort of hinting at here. I've known all my life that my grandparents and parents were born in eastern Ukraine, but I didn't know exactly where. And a few months ago, in conjunction with a novel I'm writing about that world, I located the exact village thanks to Google Maps and Google View. I've even got a sense of the country around it. And there was a real satisfaction with that, being able to connect with a definite place, even though I barely knew my grandparents. And I've never been anywhere near this village. It, knowing where it is, nevertheless, is very emotionally satisfying.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember who it was, but someone told me that you had a varied background in your preparation to be here in the Unitarian Church today. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. I was raised Roman Catholic, and I sucked up Roman Catholic ritual like a sponge. Not so much the politics, or the dogma, but the ritual. I really loved that. And then when I came out, when I was 17, I had been very, very involved in the music program. I played handbells, I sang in choir, I led the congregation in singing, and all of that was closed. It was gone. My whole community there, dozens of people, were gone. So I sort of wandered in the wilderness for a little bit, and then, like many other young women in the early 90s, I discovered what we then talked about as goddess spirituality, and then moved into a sort of broader earth-based community. And I liked the openness of that world. And it was another place, you know, the jump from Roman Catholicism to earth-based ritual is not a big jump. It's really not. I think the jump from, you know, congregationalism or being Mennonite to an earth-based tradition might be bigger because I already had all the smells and bells, right? I just wore different clothes. So, and Mary wasn't cut off at the knees anymore, right? She was, you know, the goddess was had a place, and God had a place too, and male, female, both, neither, there was. And my father, in his last years of life, he was an English professor and a professor of poetry and a professor of the Bible as literature, but he was not a believer himself. And so he always engaged sacred texts with this passionate love and desire for the text. And I inherited that without inheriting, again, dogma or a particular set of doctrine. So my wife and I were in Washington, D.C. The story is very long, but it's getting shorter, I promise. We're in D.C., and we were going to go to the Quaker meeting. We had been part of a Quaker meeting in Morgantown, West Virginia. We had investigated Judaism when we were in Morgantown. But we were going to a Quaker meeting, and we were late. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to a Quaker service or a Quaker meeting, but it's silent, right? Except when people are moved to speak. And I thought, I can't go to a meeting late, right? Open the door, creak, stomp, 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 find your seat. No. So Julie looked out the window and said, hey, that's All Souls Unitarian. I've heard of them, and they're supposed to be good, and their service doesn't start for 15 minutes. And the rest is history. And that was about 10 years ago. I had attended a Unitarian church in my hometown, but it was at All Souls DC that I really caught the Unitarian Universalist interest in history and the ministry. So you can blame Madeline for that big, long answer. Yes?
Have you ever done DNA analysis?
I haven't.
What's your question?
Have I ever done DNA analysis? My known ancestors are Irish, Scottish, English, and German. So it's never felt, you do, it's never, I haven't ever felt drawn to it, actually. Have you? Is that something you've explored?
Well, I haven't gotten the results back yet,
oh.
But I have set a way for them,
mm-hmm.
And it's going to be really interesting because I grew up with a lot of family stories, mm. And my great uncle, starting with my great grandfather, did a lot of family history,
mm-hmm.
And so especially on my mom's side, I know, you know, all the ancestry, and then she managed to find out my dad was adopted, she managed mm-hmm. to find out about his ancestry, and so I've always been kind of pretty comfortable with what that is and felt like I had more information than most people.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a friend who's Mexican, and she always wondered why she was pretty fair-skinned, and she did this DNA analysis and found out that she's part Lebanese. And that kind of opened up this whole, wow, you know, maybe, well, I went to Greece and everybody thought I was Greek. Well, my mom never said I was Greek. Maybe there's some information
right.
I don't know about. So.
Right, right. It can be interesting. You know, my mother's family has one of her sisters, or a couple of her sisters. Remember I said there were 12 of them. 8 girls and 4 boys have gotten together and done a lot of genealogical stuff. And they're, you know, Birmingham, Finder, Fisher, all kinds of like German, a little bit of Irish. And then 8 generations ago appears Elisabetta Stratagere. Okay. So there's this Italian woman far back in my history. And I'm fascinated by what story is there.
Yeah.
You know, what is the story there? Yes.
So I just have to say, so I was in Alaska for a number of years, and I was a surgeon there, and I had a patient who was an elderly Haida woman who came from a remote village, and I had not been there. And of course, she found out I was Jewish. She said, "I am too." And it turned out that her great grandfather had been a fur trader who had her grandfather had been a fur trader who had had a relationship with her grandmother and came back every summer and had 3 children and wanted her to move to New York with him, and she wouldn't hear of it.
Hmm.
So whenever she came to town from her remote village, she'd come and she said, "We're probably related." And she would come and we would have coffee together.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
Yeah. Unexpected DNA.
So I was born and raised in Mississippi, and on Mama's side there was 12,
mm-hmm.
and on Daddy's side there was 11,
mm-hmm.
and they were really, really poor Mississippi mm-hmm. dirt farmers. My dad went to the 4th grade. He could not read and write. I taught him how to sign his name in cursive mm-hmm. when I was learning to write my name in the 4th grade. So as I've matured and become an adult and moved on in my life, Mississippi has haunted me in a way. It's been something I've needed to get over, like being a Southern Baptist, you know, you recover from these kinds of things. And so I now have 3 grandsons, and last year the oldest one had to do a genealogy project in school. And he called me on the phone in the afternoon and asked me if I could go back 5 generations in my family and tell him who all the people were. And I said, you know, I'll work on it. So I went to Google and put my dad's name in first. And amazingly, my dad was born in 1897, fought in World War I, and his World War I picture came up on the screen. And his parents' names, who all of his kids were, they had me down as a man. Pat Moffitt was a man. And then at the end of it, it said, you know, you could click on his mom and dad's name. So I clicked on his dad's name, and lo and behold, a whole screen came up about Charlie Moffitt, a man that I had never knew. I never knew any of my grandparents. They were all dead when I was born. And then when I clicked on Charlie Moffitt, it went back to his father, who was Robert Moffitt.
Wow.
And then I clicked on Robert Moffitt. Now, this is the amazing thing. It went back to his father, and his father was Eli Moffitt. My grandson, who had me do this project's name, is Eli.
Wow.
Nobody knew when they named Eli that there was an ancestor named Eli Moffitt. And the other thing was that there was about 8 screens worth of stuff on this Eli Moffitt. He had been a famous person.
Mm-hmm.
He was rich. He was wealthy. There was this whole team of bandits who were looking for him in Mississippi right along the Civil War times. They robbed his house and took all of his gold, and he was an engineer. He had gone to college. He was educated, and so this finding this out had the effect of reaching back into my low class past and redeeming it. Because I had this Eli Moffat dude who was, he went to college and he was rich and all that, and they had 8 pages on him on the internet.
Yeah.
So the magic of that kind of redemption from...
Well, and I think it's also important, those of us who are lucky enough to have experiences like that and have, tremendous numbers of generations that we can know by name, that's important. Many of the people that I know from All Souls who are African American just made a trip to Ghana and saw the ports where Africans were taken on the Middle Passage, where millions of people died who are nameless to us. Who then continued to be brutalized and killed. And it's a huge privilege, I think, to know the names and to be able to speak the names. But none of us knows all our ancestors, right? None of us has all of them, because we're sort of all each other's ancestors in a certain way, because we all give one another these effects, these gifts. But I am just very aware sometimes of, my grandmother's trip to China in the 40s. I have all kinds of Chinese objects, a big soapstone Kuan Yin. So maybe it was my grandmother who got me started on this world religions kick. It's just something that's very tender to me. And so I lift up your story of the ease that you had in finding Eli, and whose stories have not been told, whose stories are invisible. Yes,
I heard something once, and it was, you're not gone until the last person who knows you speaks your name for the last time. And I just, it seems so sad.
Yeah.
So the whole ancestry thing is wonderful, and I'm into it.
Yeah. I don't know how long you all generally go. I mean, we could talk all afternoon, but I'll be around at coffee hour. Are we about done?
That's fine.
Okay.
We have to afford to deal with other people.
Is there one more person, maybe?
We can talk.
No.
At the same time.
Okay. We can do everything at the same time.
Thank you so much.